Welcome to the last paper session of ICLDC 5. Hope you've all really enjoyed the conference. I have. It's good to be here every couple of years. So I want to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Benedicto from Purdue University, and she's going to be talking about strong sense of identity as part of cultural well-being through documenting plant knowledge. So I'll hand it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming in this last day of the very busy conference. So the work that I'm going to present is a collaborative work under a participatory action research methodology that we have been doing together with Mayangna Yulbaran-Yangbalna, Elizabeth Salomon, who is a member of the indigenous linguist team, was supposed to come here, and she was recently promoted to director of the Linguistic Institute in Huracan, and so she could not come. So it's for a good reason that she's not coming, but it's a pity that she didn't make it here. So first of all, I want to do the acknowledgments instead of leaving them for the last part of the talk. I want to thank all the knowledge bearers that shared their knowledge with us in this project, and all the community members that contributed to it. And we also have to acknowledge the money that we got from several grants at Purdue and the generous use of the facilities at Ipil Huracan in Rosita. So I'm going to structure the talk in this way. I'm gonna present first the underlying idea for the relation between linguistic documentation and well-being. I'm going to present the project that we worked on, divided in three phases, and then I'm going to have final thoughts and considerations. So let's go with the idea. The main underlying idea is that loss of cultural identity leads to sense of unwell-being. I want to also emphasize not only the physical part of health, but the cultural, mental, and spiritual part of well-being of health. That triggers or that leads to the weakening of the anchoring where any human being can thrive. Every human being needs some kind of cradle, some kind of nest where they can develop properly. And that weakening of the density of cultural content, and I'm going to use that notion of density of cultural content, leads to a debilitated cultural system and an diminished sense of cohesion and belonging for the individuals and the communities. So what is a healthy cultural system? In order to address that, in order to address the top part of it, I'm gonna use the metaphor of the weaving and use the notions of thickness and complexity. So if we have something like that as an abstraction of the weaving of the cultural content, we can see that it can be supplemented by the complexity of the weaving and also by the complexity of the threads that go in that. So that provides thickness and different texture. So the one on the right is much more supportive, much more complex, much more thick than the one on the left. So what we want to work on, that idea that the loss of density in a cultural system is going to weaken that anchoring of a human being. So think of, if you have seen some Navajo basket weaving, they are very tightly woven, water doesn't go through it. If you think of the weaving as something that goes from left to right, the weaving on the right lets water go through, and so that's where people also, the well-being of people can go through, is not sustained. That can happen also with the replacement. So that's supposed to be light blue, and it's not coming out very much, but sometimes it's not just the thinning of the cultural density, but also the replacement of some of the threads with elements from other cultures. So basically you end up with a weaving that contains threads from other cultures, and your sense of self and identity gets lost. So that's where we get at those 2 points that we were talking about before. And that, of course, is also related to some things that the Miami team was talking about yesterday, about reintroducing the sense of identity to create belongingness. So we are trying to address these issues through a documentation project that was born within the framework of participatory action research and the collaboration of the authors. So the team of indigenous researchers, the Mayangna, Yulbara, and Yangbalna, which is a native-born team of indigenous linguists, and myself in a community, in a set of communities in eastern Nicaragua, which are the Sumu Mayangna, and I'm just going to put out the maps there just to remind everybody where things are. The areas where we are working are this one, and this one. And as you see, most of it is territory that is also shared with the Miskito. So the main proposition of this idea is that reinforcing cultural awareness through a documentation process that feeds into a variety of culturally appropriate channels increases the density of the cultural tissue and increases a sense of cultural belonging and thus cultural well-being. So that's the notion of cultural well-being, not just physical health, but cultural health. So what we want to do is to go from a system like that to a system that incorporates more complexity in the tissue and more complexity in the threads that form that tissue. And so the picture on the right is going to give a healthier cultural well-being for the people. So we are adding thickness and complexity. So this documentation project and the actions taken around it focuses on recovering plant knowledge and refeeding the results back to the community at large through culturally appropriate ways. And that is super important because sometimes we do things, we print them in books, the books stay on the shelves, collect dust, and never do anything. We feel good because we did something, but it actually is not doing anything. So that was a very important point of what we were doing. It has to go back in culturally appropriate ways. And the goal, as we mentioned, was to redensify the cultural tissue and with it increase the sense of cultural well-being. So the project is divided in 3 phases, and I'm going to talk about first the identification of the problem. That was the first phase. It came from the realization within the activities of BAR in our group that there was loss of a good portion of cultural knowledge about the existence and use of the forest, the plants in the forest. And that's something that they brought to our regular meetings. So it was a project that was initiated within the community with parameters determined by the members of the indigenous research team. And I adapted. You want to do this, then let's work together, let's define it, and let's do it. But it's your idea and your methods and everything. The main motivation was to counteract the effects of cultural loss, especially on youth, but also in the general population. The second phase is that of documentation, and it has 4 stages. The first one is the preliminary, where there was identification of knowledge bearers, data collection, data systematization, and transmission and dissemination. So I'm going to address them in turn. So in the preliminary stage, the indigenous team identified the knowledge bearers in their own communities. So those communities, those areas that I showed you, is where basically they come from. So they began with what they knew. So they could identify the people in their community. It was not a straightforward step, but they knew who to begin with. And they did that in the 2 dialect or regional areas, the Tuajca near the Bambana River, and the Panamaca around the Waspuk and the Wawa rivers. And together, the knowledge bearers and the indigenous researchers, they identified the locations to visit, and they set a schedule of visits to the forest, including different times during the year, because it was obvious that plants have a life cycle, and during that life cycle, they look and they do different things. In the second step, there was the data collection. It was carried out by the local teams of indigenous researchers and the local knowledge bearers, and with field trips. So what John Elliott yesterday was calling bush walks to the forest. And plants and plant parts are documented with pictures. So for every plant, we may have between 5 and 10 pictures, each focusing on different parts. Voice recordings, and because Nicaragua is Nicaragua, things don't always work, a lot of hand note taking. So when the voice recorder failed, they used paper and pencil, like in the olden times. In numbers, we collected about information about around 560 plants, 230 of those in Panamaca with notes and audio, and 330 in Tuaca with audio, basically. Their equipment worked better. And we also obtained a lot of local classification, which was a bonus for the project. So just to show you some examples of pictures, that's the back side of one of the leaves. So you can see the nerving and things that are relevant for classification. This one, even though you cannot see it very well, shows this is araskasnin, and it shows that the stem, the twig, is square, which leads you to know that plant belongs to the mint family. The mint family is the one that has the square stem. An example of how in the first two we used to have a white either cloth or paper to focus on what we wanted to focus. If we didn't have that, we could use a piece of wood that would provide a blank background to the picture. And then, for instance, this is a very interesting picture. I got a second discipline fellowship and I began to learn about plants, and one of the things that I discovered is that plants ingest food, not always through leaves, but sometimes through these organs that are in the middle of leaves, and they are like a button with a mouth. And so we also wanted to document that and to see if they had any names for those parts. Very interesting work on meronymic systems came out of this project. So on the data systematization, the third step, all the audio and visual data was transcribed in ELAN, and information was organized and systematized in an Excel database. We used Excel because they pirated it and it's cheap. They don't have to pay for it and they have it available. Don't say it. So we gather information about physical properties of plants. That would be the shape of the stem, the shape, texture, and layout of the leaves, flowers and fruits, the timing when the flowers came out, when the fruits were formed, and so on. Local ethnoclassification, uses and handling of the plants, indications what they were used for, which part of the plant was used, how to prepare the plant parts, and how to apply it. The first set was, for some reason, and I guess that it had to do with something, but I don't know exactly what, the Panamaca teams focused especially on that, whereas the Tuaca teams focused especially on the uses. I don't know, there has to be something in the way the things were done. This is a sample of the Excel database. So here on the left, we have the unique identifier for each plant, which includes the name of the collector, of the Mayangna researcher in charge of it, the name in Mayangna, the dialect, the pictures collected about it. This is about the use. You see that this is for the Spanish, is buried, so we don't care too much about getting the Spanish counterparts. Many of them don't have a Spanish counterpart. And then all this here is about the leaves. The stem and the color, the flowers, okay? So this is just to give you an idea. The transmission and dissemination about the decision-making about it. It was the indigenous researchers, the knowledge bearers, and the community members, the elders, who decided which knowledge to transmit and to whom. And this is very important. Yesterday in Tchaikovsky and colleagues' talk, we heard about issues of sovereignty and who makes the decision and how we manage those things. So this is an important part. Priority was given to the local school system. This is a system that was created back in the 80s with the revolution. The whole school system is in the language. It's one of the most progressive. The implementation is not always good, but it's a good system. And the goal was to rechannel the information back to the community through the school system, through the children, and to engage children with the older generation. In some of the work about the diagnosis of the school system, it was being seen that there was a split, and this wanted to re-tie the elders and the community back to the school system, and to re-engage the older generation, parents and grandparents, into the school system, come back, talk to us, engage with us. The final part, the actual dissemination, crucially establishes which parts of the documentation is going to be made public and how. And what the Indigenous team decided, again in consultation with the elders, was to prepare documents with information on the shape of the plant, but minimal information on the use of the plants, which was to be furnished into the traditional ways, so through the family. In some talks with some Ojibwe researchers 2 weeks ago, they told me to beware because that knowledge is lost, and then they have very little information. They begin to reuse plants, and maybe they use them in a bad way, and that can be poisonous, that can be dangerous. So there was a word of caution there, but it's their decision, and I can only just transmit that part. They decided to produce an encyclopedia-like book out of which materials could be drawn for the school system. So the school materials that were structured specifically for the classroom and specifically for primary school grades. The two are not the same, and you really need specific school materials for it to work. So some final thoughts. The project was initiated by concerns of the Mayangna researchers, but what does the rest of the community think and feel? These researchers are researchers. They are people that went through the university, that have a special way of thinking, special awareness. What does the rest of the community think? So they engage in an ongoing qualitative study that now through the university, through Huracán, about the Mayangna notions of well-being. And here are a couple of things that are coming out of the ongoing project. So one of the elders said, and the translation is mine, to live well is to have the basics, food, forest, and water. The animals to be able to sell and get money to obtain necessary things that are not available in the forest. Another one, it is to be healthy, to have a job and a home. Also to live in peace, in harmony with everybody, to take care of the forest. And that's translated from the words of the Mayangna elders. This project has also been an opportunity for refining and rethinking the PAR methodology. So part of that methodology is constant evaluation, constant assessment, how are we doing? And so that provided one more opportunity to rethink the relation between the internal and the external members of the team at large. And to rethink the relation between the internal researchers and the members of the community. How doing this kind of work separates them from the community, how they are being seen as different or not. Notions of agency and time, this was definitely an agentive project on their part. Time was very interesting because time in academic environments is very different than time in the field. And that's one of the places where, I mean, academia does not take that into account. So we got initial funding. We did the 1 year, January through December. December 31st, the budget is closed, it's over, you're done. And then the project continued for 5-6 years, still going on. And we are going at the rhythm of the local polychronic time sense of time. Consequences for the usual requirements for archival of documentation and ultimately for the declared and undeclared, and those are the ones, that's my petty point, undeclared goals of documentation in academia and the Western goal. in the Western world. Who are we documenting for? Are we reproducing the schemas of the 19th century where we were collecting artifacts from sites? And now that there are no more artifacts, are we collecting linguistic data and putting them in museums called archives as we did 100 years ago with artifacts? And if we are doing that, are we okay with that? Thank you. So that raises issues of sovereignty, true equal-to-equal partnerships as the ones that Tchaikovsky and colleagues were discussing yesterday, an integrated transdisciplinary maybe, non-binary collaborations. It's not that I'm bringing one kind of knowledge and they are bringing another kind. We are constantly interweaving those knowledges and they are as much linguists as I am. So Tinky Palni, thanks.
So we have about 10 minutes for questions, and I'll let you field those. Any questions?
I'll ask something. This participatory action framework, it's coming from cultural anthropology, is that right? Can you talk a little bit about that framework?
Well. Yeah, in Nicaragua it was used by sociologists more than anthropologists. And there was very little done in linguistics. So we took some of the models that we had seen. Some of my students also saw things that doctors and health professionals had been using. I used the sociologist thing because they had worked in Nicaragua after the revolution. They knew well what was happening in the Pacific coast, not in the eastern coast. So I used that as a stepping point, and then we discussed and we talked and we decided to create whatever. I mean, we keep using the word, but we adapted it to the medium. And so the main point is to rebalance the power structures, to make sure that we undo all those power hierarchies, that we work equal to equal, that they are included, they are the main part in the decision process, and that we all have a say in the methodology. So it's very much into this weaving, like a braid, think of a braid, way of doing things.
That makes a lot of sense. It doesn't fit very well with academia, especially in linguistics departments.
Right.
So that's been a challenge for
Well, imagine an English department. An English department.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why I said in the last slide, all the conflicts with academia.
Yeah.
The time is, I mean, I saw many heads moving when I mentioned the time, and we all know that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that either we change academia, which we can do in some ways, we can force their arm, or we do what we can to fit into that train, but then go off and do our thing. And you can do those things when you have a job, when you have job security, all those things. So I realize that not everybody can, but I think that those of us that can should begin to do it. And I began to do it when I was a graduate student. So thanks to my mentors, I was able to do that and then continue with this.
So one challenge I faced when trying to approach my research in that way is how to get IRB protocols approved when you are explicitly stating that the kind of implementation of the research project will be dependent on input throughout the process from the community. So I'm wondering if you have any.
A lot of education. In the beginning, I was very mad at my IRB. I said, these people don't know anything. They are such a bunch of ignorant. So that doesn't get you anywhere. It just gets you, well-being, right? I went to their office. I discovered that they were very nice women that had a lot of stressful lives like me. And so we sat and we talked. And I informed them of what was happening. And there was a process of mutual education because I knew what was going on their side and my side. And I've been doing this for 20 years. And now we have a very stable process where they just fight with me to do the renewals on time. But they know what the issues are. We have worked a consent form in which we don't need to use a written consent form. It can be oral. There doesn't need to be money involved, because sometimes money is bad. It murks everything. There are other ways of recognizing their work and thanking them, and there is this bitty bitty. You do it for me, I do it for you. And so by now they recognize all those things.
I mean, I think it would be helpful to have a paper about this with regards to research protocols that we could cite in our protocol applications, like, so that we don't all have to do all this individual education.
The LSA has worked on this issue for a long time. Contact the people at the LSA, NSF, there were workshops, and there have been great changes in our academic time in what the IRB will and will not do, and why they can't treat all of us like we're going to remove people's brains or something like that.
Ruth means.
And
what I've heard in my own department is, can you cite any paper on that? So sometimes you write those things just to have a reference that you can cite and give it.
That's what I mean.
Because all they want is peace of mind. All they want is to cover their backs so that nobody can tell them you did this or that wrong. So you produce that piece of paper and
you can say, look, somebody did that.
Another IRB already is doing that, so you can cite the precedent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the LSA has done that or not.
Yeah, if they have, that's great, and we should.
What they did a number of years ago, working with some of the federal funding agencies, is develop a much better overall system of the kinds of commissions that linguists need to have that make more sense. So, at my university, I did something like what you did, where I argued that speakers' names definitely had to be associated with the narratives they produced because they were their works.
Yes.
And it would be unfair to the communities and to the speakers themselves not to give them the credit for their work.
And that you don't want to destroy it after you're done. You want to preserve it. I think there was a last one over there.
Last question. Yeah, so when you have knowledge bearers who wish to share their knowledge and plans with you, but not with external people, how do you come about with that? How do you deal with that?
Well, we mark what is to be shared and what is not. And there are things that I can see and not share, and there are things that I cannot even see. So the researchers, the Mayangnat researchers, are the ones in charge of getting that. Now, we are discussing those things now because they don't want to archive. So we haven't had funding for a long time because NSF wants archiving. It's like, either you do it or I don't give you the money. It's like, okay, keep your money. But then they also want to preserve it. And it's in the forest, it's in the jungle. So one of the things that they are considering now is whether through the local university they want to set up a server that they could keep it there or something. They don't always trust that university. So there have been times where the university has wanted to publish things that they didn't want, or has wanted to put the copyright on things that they think is theirs. So there is this ongoing conversation about how to do it. They want to preserve those things. They want to keep control over that. And in order to keep control over that, they are not a tribe like here in the States. So it's a hard thing. There was a work done in the 80s and 90s on this, on plants. Nobody knows where that is. The person that did it died. And one of the things they wanted to do is go to the family and see if anybody kept a copy of it. Because those are the risks. On the other hand, they are accepting those risks. So it's their choice. Their knowledge, their language, their choice. Sounds like a feminist.
All right, well, thank you so much, Dr.
Thank you.